Yo, check this out. This is Fresh Get Out the China Man with the 2 Live Crew.
Yo, what's up, y'all? It's me, DMC.
What's up, y'all? This is the boy, Master P.
Yo, check us out. Chuck the Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yellow from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DLC.
This is your boy, C-Murder.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfucker.
This is your boy, DJ Paul KOL 365.
Young Dizzy Bomb.
Vice One.
Yo, this is DJ Ready Brand.
What up? This is the real Rick Ross. You listen to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
This is a show that shows no limits, broadcast nothing but the real. Interviews with legendary artists, still got love for the underground feel. Rappers with records, revealing addition, and rappers are coming up, getting put on. We need to the platform to fight the mainstream. The show that you need to be on. Hit up UGS for life on the screen and follow with Wizard.com. For all of your needs, production and mixing and mastering, graphics and shadow design. Check out the archives and touch with the shows. Plenty of content and communities. Through everything free to download and stream. Oh yeah, we deserve the real.
I'm
talking
about what we be, we fight up, it's we represent. All them chillers on the mic and wish your love to all your fans. Motherfuckers wanna hate, do your thing, you keep the focus. Bringing nothing but the rules to come and tune into the dopest.
I'm a man-made guy, crazy knocking all you rappers off.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's your boy Prez here on the Murder Master Music Show, episode 599. Man, we're going to switch it up. You know, we usually do the hip-hop thing, of course, as you know, but today we got a special treat for you. One of the biggest films from the 80s was The Karate Kid, and now it's back. Cobra Kai is one of the biggest new TV series, or web series, I should say. 100% Rotten Tomatoes last year. Series was phenomenal. Today, our guest is the one and only Martin Cove. Let me bring him on, Sensei Kreese of Cobra Kai. How you doing, Martin?
I'm good. Just worked out. We're out here in Dallas doing a movie. And then we come back into L.A. We have the L.A. premiere on the 22nd at the Paley Center, which is a big TV center. And it's very exciting. And then the show airs April 24th in season two. It's very exciting.
It's a phenomenal show. I saw the first season, and you guys really set the bar high. Of course, you came in at the end of the first season, left everybody, you know, cliffhanger, waiting to see what's going to happen in season two. When I saw the trailer for season two, I thought, man, I think they nailed it again, it looks like. How different is season two compared to season one? Do you think it tops season one, or what are your thoughts on it, Mark?
Well, yeah, it tops season one because it's, you know, it's written so well in general. It's written so well, and you know, I mean, I did 6 years on Cagney and Lacey, and that was written very well, and you know, there are elements to it where it takes the characters, you know, into an arc, you know, like, you know, Billy Zabka's character, you know, Johnny Lawrence. I mean, he goes from, there are no white hats and black hats, you know, and I think the success that we have today on television, there's a lot of terrific writing, is that the characters are gray and they're not like white hats and black hats. So you highly identify with them. And kids today, you know, many of them didn't see Karate Kid as a feature, unless their parents, you know, made them look at it on cable or even on a DVD. So what they identify with and why they like it and why, you know, it's so popular is because they identify with the situations of the teenagers. And then, of course, you know, the darkness of, you know, John Kreese, which is always interesting because, you know, people refer to me as the Darth Vader of the karate world. But yet everybody likes a fun villain. But I believe that, you know, the true source of it is that the teenagers in the show are being identified with the audience, and the audience vice versa.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just love playing to the audiences because it's such a versatile written show.
Yeah. absolutely. And, you know, season one, it kind of humanized Johnny Lawrence's character because, you know, that guy was, like, also one of the greatest villains of the 80s, so to speak. Does season two kind of humanize John Kreese in a way?
I can't tell you too much because, you know, I can't give you any spoils. But, you know,
yes.
they developed the character very well. You know, when I originally came on the show, you know, they told me I was going on episode 10, and I couldn't go on any earlier because I was setting up season two, and then I become a regular in season two and three. And they develop him so well. These three writers, you know, John Hurwitz and Hayden Schlossberg and Josh Hale, I mean, they write full characters. These guys wrote Harold and Kumar and Hot Tub Time Machine. So, you know, they created their own little Star Wars, you know? And anybody could make Karate Kid 4, Karate Kid 5, you just copy what was. They created their own new environment, their own geography, their own, you know, form of communication with these kids. And it's a whole new environment, you know? It's an entirely new environment, and there's a lot of darkness and a lot of lightness. And my character is developed. I can't give you too much, but you'll really like it because I didn't want to play a stoic kind of guy anymore. I mean, I wasn't interested in doing that. And yet he is a hard ass, but he's got multiple colors, which is so much fun to play as an actor.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you just said that you signed on for season two and season three. So people listening are going to be excited to hear the Cobra Kai's coming back for season three, hopefully many more after that. But you're going to be in season three as well.
Yeah, well, we haven't officially, you know, put it out there, season three. But if there's a season three, which I really feel there will be, because this season two is even richer than season one, you know.
Wow.
And it's just, we would be shooting, I guess, say episode 7, episode 8, and then we're in Atlanta, and then we'd be doing pickup shots from episode 2 and episode 4, and you know, it was exhausting because there'd be two or three crews happening at the same time. But the material was so rich, so you couldn't complain as an actor. You're working long hours. You would, the writers were directing and editing and rewriting. They were working, you know, around the clock. And the shows were so good. So you didn't mind operating at such a, you know, intense level as an actor. And that's why season two is even richer than season one, because the shows are overwritten. The shows are written like little movies, you know, and they're written to the point where you literally, you know, you have to binge. You can't just watch one or two and then go to sleep and wake up and watch the next ones on Wednesday and the next on Friday. You can't do that. It lures you in, like the old 40 serials in the movie theaters. They lure you in, you know, cliffhangers. And you love the characters, so you want to watch more and more.
Yeah, and nothing lures you in like the end scene of season one when you come walking through the door. When I saw that, I automatically knew, like, okay, they just raised the stakes. This is amazing, but like you said, the writing had to be perfect, and that's why I think it did so good. You know, the writing for this, it, like you said, it not only brings back the people that grew up off the Karate Kid and whatnot, but it's going to have a whole new audience as well, because kids can identify with the younger characters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on that promo, I mean, I've been out of town shooting, but my son keeps me abreast of all the numbers, and you know, 3-4 million people have watched that promo within the first 3 days, you know? And it just goes to show you the amount of people anticipating the show and looking forward to the show. And I just think that the kids who don't, as I said before, the kids who don't know the movies, go back and watch the movies. I think that you know, Columbia's coming out, Sony's coming out with a whole new 4K Blu-ray that's going to be incredible, you know, just incredible, a DVD. And it's got all kinds of commentaries from all of us on that. And things were taken from a lot of the YouTube, you know, had a variety of different conventions, and so did Sony. And we went to them, and we had interviews, and a lot of these interviews are posted on that DVD. And it's brilliant. I mean, I can't wait to get it. You know, I mean, if it came out tomorrow, I'd go over here in Dallas and buy one. I mean, because it tells the secrets of why we all think this show is popular. And nobody takes anything for granted because, you know, things in this business change overnight, you know. Yeah. There's so much competition on television because I believe that most people are getting tired of Marvel comic books in the movies. So that's why that's why television is so richly written, because so many of the great writers have moved from, you know, trying to get their pictures produced. I'm a big Western fan. Trying to get a Western produced in Hollywood is a killer. But you can get the same project done on, you know, on YouTube, Sony, Netflix, in a smaller version for television, and you just adapt the screenplay. But, you know, to me, the American heritage in cinema is basically the Western. I believe that the Western is, you know, neglected now, and eventually it'll come back. But it'll come back probably, you know, more on television, because it's easier to get something made on television, because, you know, if you're not a Marvel comic book, you're not getting into the theaters, you know?
Yeah, they seem to dominate the box offices. And usually people that go to see them never read a comic book in their lives, so I don't understand it myself. But speaking of Westerns, I remember seeing an interview with you, it might have been a couple years back. You were speaking of you were going to be in Tom Horn with legendary Steve McQueen, rest in peace, which later you had a chance to work with his son, Chad, in The Karate Kid. Why didn't that happen? They did not want you for the role, or was the role not right for you?
It was the most regrettable thing I've ever had happen to me. I literally left, you know, I didn't even read. I just, back in 77, I think, and I wanted to work in the Western, and Steve McQueen was my idol. And I went and visited my parents in New York, and I arrived to a phone call in their house in Queens, New York, and they said, well, you got to come back tomorrow. They want you for this week's work with Steve McQueen playing Gentleman Jim Corbett, the fighter, Tom Horn.
Yeah.
And the whole week's work was fighting Steve McQueen in this scene, right? I mean, and somehow, and I said, well, and then they wanted to pay scale, which was like the lowest they could pay. But it wasn't that so much. It was really that I looked at my parents who were standing there and they were really happy to see me. And I literally walked in the room an hour before from L.A. And I didn't have the heart to pick my ass up and leave in the morning. You know, I just couldn't do it. So I said, no, I'll pass on it. And to this day, and then it was his last Western, and to this day I so regret I could have, because I know because there's so many things about Steve McQueen's work that I loved, and I talked to him about it, and not just be a glitzy fan, but talk to him about moments in Sand Pebbles, moments in The Magnificent Seven, moments in, you know, Sex and the Single Girl. You know, there were just just great things to talk about, and I knew I'd become friends with this guy. I mean, I knew it. And all of a sudden, the moronic Martin Cove decided not to go, you know? So for me, it was the biggest mistake I ever made. And I told this to Chad, his son, and he laughed about it, you know, because, you know, he of course, loved his father so much.
I loved him in The Karate Kid. I wonder why he didn't do much more after that. But yeah, I can imagine the regret you have, because that would have been pretty cool to spend a week with him, get to know him, you know, so to speak. But you did get to meet his son and talk to him, you know, so that kind of made up for it a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, we keep in touch. He's a good boy. He lives out in California. And we talked, and, you know, there's this, you know, part of season two is a really good episode. I can't give you too much information, but it's a really great episode, you know, about the old Cobra Kai. And it's great stuff. Great stuff. Can't tell you much about it, but it's really And, you know, he's Chad, you know, he sort of manages, I think, a race car team. And he lives out there in California, out in the desert. And great guy. Lovely fellow. Lovely fellow.
Yeah, I think another thing that really worked well with the writing, how they wrote it, was you when you're watching it, you don't know whether to root for, you know, LaRusso or Lawrence. You know, sometimes you're thinking, okay, LaRusso's the bad guy here. You know, it's not Cobra Kai that are the bad guys. And, you know, it goes back and forth like that. It really captures the emotions of the viewer. And I think that's why, a big reason why it's a hit, too. You felt the same way about that?
Yeah, well, I found that over the years, there's three, and I've said this before, there's three reasons why the movie is so identifiable to people back in 1984. Number one, they either had a romance that didn't work out back in high school like that, or they were a fish out of water. Their parents might have been moving, parents in the military and all, and they were fish out of water many times, going to different schools. Or they were bullied. And one of those three things usually rings forth for someone who just loves the movie and has become a huge fan. And I don't think that happens. That could happen now if the kids watch the movies. But when you're that age, you know, I think now that the series captures a lot of audience enormously, the perils and the crises of the teenagers in the show captures a lot of the audience. Most of the initial audience back in, you know, 35 years ago, they were that age of Ralph and Billy. And they identified with, as I said, most of the things that those three were going on, that they were feeling emotionally, you know, Ralph and Billy's character. Because to this day, John Kreese never has surrendered to the fact that the Karate Kid, the real champion of the All Valley tournament, was Ralph. It wasn't. It was not Daniel LaRusso. Daniel LaRusso used a kick that was totally unethical and illegal. So the crane kick was used illegally. So Johnny Lawrence is truly the Karate Kid, and John Kreese has never forgotten that.
Yeah, and that the animosity lives on. You know what I'm saying? And LaRusso wants to do everything he can to shut down Cobra Kai, so it's going to be interesting to see that go back and forth. After you signed on to do this project, did you initially think that it would have this much of an impact? Because it seems like it's reigniting a whole new generation.
Karate Kid has never really left us. You know, we it has always been there for 35 years, and everybody values it so much, and, you know, the characters are remembered daily, you know, whether we bump into people on the streets or people in the business. And, you know, it's an iconic film because of Robert Kamen. You know, Robert Kamen wrote, you know, and I've mentioned this before, how many movies can you say where you remember so many lines that are 35 years old? I mean, Mercy is for the weak. Wax on, wax off. No mercy. You know, if you try to think about all the movies over the last 50 years, maybe you remember The Force Be With You, or in The Godfather you remember I'm Going to Make You an Offer You Can't Refuse, or Casablanca, my favorite film of all time, Play It Again, Sam. You know, but we've had, the guy wrote just a wonderful, wonderful screenplay, you know, incredible, you know, literary giant. And he wrote something that everybody could identify with. And the mere fact that we say these words, adults say them. I'll go into an area, press a button, and what do I get from the total stranger? Instead of him saying, okay, and opening up the gate, security guard, he'll go, no mercy. I mean, I don't even know who the guy is. But the thing is, looking a little screen, they see who it is, and it's ironic. It's all ironic, iconic, and it's, I think, a bit of literature that never leaves us because it was written so well. And so Karate Kid has never gone anywhere, you know, 35 years. It just has never been on TV in such an appreciated level, you know, because you can watch it over and over and over again, moment by moment, and really see the scenarios of what's going on with these people today, and not in 1984, but today, you know?
No. Like I said, it's a whole new generation. And the kids that are in it today, who knows, 30 years from now, there might be a reboot with them. You know what I mean? It's a beautiful thing. It really is. It's good to see. You've been a part of a lot of franchises that were highly successful. And as we're talking about Cobra Kai and everything, Karate Kid, as you know, Rambo's getting ready to go out. Last Blood, the last film. You were in its most successful film, Rambo 2. What are your thoughts on that film finally ending, you know, after all these years? And if you can, how was it to be in that film with Stallone and Krenna and to be able to do that?
Well, you know, when that script came to me, Karate Kid was very popular. It made like $100 million. And then I was still doing Tagging and Lacey. And this script came to me of 85 pink pages of mayhem. Just mayhem. I think Sly had 9 lines. I mean, you know, Sly had 9 lines. I had more lines than he did. And he and I, you know, we were friends in New York ages ago. You know, we did, when we came to town, we did Capone with Ben Gazzara and Susan Blakely. We did that at Fox. And that was the first year we were in town, like, it was 74. And then we did the other movie a couple of months later together again. We did Death Race 2000. And, you know, I remember him holding the script and saying, what is this? And we're in the motorhome and he says, it's a movie I'm trying to get made, you know. And that was probably February of 75, as I remember. And then, of course, I remember being invited to the screening in September of 76. So in any case, he got the movie made. And then, you know, I got the call to come play with Rambo, and he and I knew each other, and it'll be fun. And it's always good coming off of a hit. And I said to myself, well, hey, you know, you're coming off of one big hit. You might as well take this, even though it didn't require a lot of acting. It was a big action picture, and he had all the you know, really good stuff. And so I went off for 3 weeks to Acapulco, took the gig, and we had a really good time. And he and I, you know, had a good time together because we were still friends. And I never knew it was going to, you know, I think the merchandising made more money than the movie. You know, I still have a battery-powered water gun from Rambo. And the first battery-powered water gun, a machine gun. It, you know, it looked like an M16. And it was a phenomenon, another phenomenon. And he's been very lucky with those phenomenons. And I remember we had the same manager, a fellow named Herbie Yannis. And I remember Herbie saying about Sly, like Sly was the fifth Beatle, you know? You know, he's been so lucky with the franchise, you know, and his popularity. So it was terrific. It was a lot of fun to make in Acapulco, doubling for Thailand. And, you know, it was good. It was a good time.
Do you have anything lined up in the future as far as any Western films? Or?
Well, right now we're shooting a really fun movie with it's almost like a Western. It's called VFW. We're shooting it in Dallas. It's like Expendables in a bar. It's with Stephen Lang and William Sadler, and it's crazy. It's and Fred Williamson and David Patrick Kelly, and it's really wild. It's about these vets who, you know, hang out in a VFW together, and all of a sudden they're besieged by bad guys because they're protecting this girl, and it's a siege movie in this bar, and it's really a lot of fun. It's just like a Western. It's like the 9 Lives of Fuego Baca, which was an old Robert Loggia movie in the 50s that was on Disney. And it was a story about a, you know, Mexican sheriff who holds off the world and back in the West in New Mexico. But it's lots of fun, lots of action, and Gil Bicos is directing it, and he directed a couple of other. It's a Fangoria movie, so it's interesting because it's part action, part horror. I've never done anything like this, but it's good stuff. It's really good stuff, and then I have Once Upon a Time in Hollywood coming out that I did for Quentin Tarantino, and that I think comes out in August, and then I've been cultivating some westerns and it's just an uphill battle to get these westerns going. I've got a couple of really good stuff, and my son Jesse Cove is an actor, and we're trying to get something going together. I think once the season comes out, it'll be a little easier to get stuff going on TV. Once season two comes out, The Karate Kid, it'll be a lot easier to make some presentations to some networks.
It's cool because you haven't gone anywhere. You've been working steadily all these years, but this is kind of almost like a revitalization of Martin Cove, in a sense, as an actor. Did you kind of feel that way? Because the world's going to be reintroduced to you again.
Yeah, a lot of people say that, and in every project you do, you're always feeling you're reinventing yourself. You do the best work you can, and you don't really, I don't know. I never had a list of how much I do one year, how much I do the next year. Each project is isolated, and each project is definitively different because the character is usually different. And so I try, I'm past that stage of trying to fix the script because I like the character. The script isn't that good, but I love the character, and I figure, well, I could do a great job with this character, and that'll fix the screenplay. And I don't do that anymore. I'm not arrogant enough to think that I could fix the screenplay because it's somewhat weak because I'm going to perform well. So I've got to be careful about that because I love, there's so many times in the past I've done movies where I've fallen in love with the characters and, not the script. So now I'm massaging a good concept in a Western, and I'd like to be able to do it with my son and a couple of other friends who just love the West. And like Kevin Costner, whenever he makes a movie, when I did Wide Earp with Kevin, that was a Western. He had everything else he did after, whether it's The Postman or Waterworld or whatever, including present day The Highwayman, which is on, terrific, terrific show. He makes it a Western. He somehow carves out the elements of the script, and you feel it like you're in the West.
Yeah, him and DePaul did a good one years ago. I forget the name of it. Open Range. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, Open Range. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah.
That was a
great film. My dad liked that film.
That was a movie where I tell a story. He wanted my kids and myself to come. He sent a car from Disney, and we went to the premiere. And everybody would always say in those days that a Western was too slow a genre for children. Children didn't have the temperament to stay with a Western. They needed to have ray guns and spaceships flying all over at a much faster pace. Yet that movie, my two kids were twins. They were 12 at the time. Or they were even younger. And they just sat there and watched that entire movie Open Range because the characters were so rich. And there were only two shootout scenes, one at the beginning, one at the end. But yet,
yeah.
I remember sitting there, Powers Booth and I were sitting there talking and just laughing the fact that these kids weren't budging. They didn't have to go to the bathroom. They weren't squirming. They were taken by the West and truly well-written characters,
It captivated them, yeah. Well, I hope you and your son get to do some stuff. I look forward to checking that out. And I got one more question before you go, Martin. Everybody wants everybody loves Pat Morita. The guy he captivated a lot of people over the years. I think he would really be proud of this. What was he like as a person? You care to share maybe a story from you and working with Pat?
The best time I had really with Pat was when I was given this script on a Monday and said I had the whole week to work with this character John Kreese, And then all of a sudden I get the call the next day to read for John Avildsen. And I was really angry. And I used my anger in the audition. And I berated him, got real angry at him, and said he was such an ass for not giving us enough time with the script. And then I went right into the scene where Mercy is for the week, here and on the street in the dojo, marching up and down the aisle. And so he loved it. He didn't have a fragile ego after being abused. And then he sent me a Jerry Weintraub. I did the same thing with Jerry. And then I remember having to read for the head of the studio, and I had to go to the set and do a scene with Pat. And Pat was so gracious. It was that scene that we do in the dojo where, I tell him, you're aggressive, I really, but I like that, and that scene where we set up Ralph having to compete against my students in the All Valley when he comes to my dojo, and it was great. And that scene, we did it, and we did, if I remember correctly, one take, because he was so gracious and giving, and we discussed it at great length, and I was kind of nervous. It's my third reading, and I really didn't know why I had to read so many times, but it was the head of the studio, and John Avildsen's assistant has the camera over his shoulder, and Pat is just below the camera, and we're just marching around a room on location. And the director wasn't there. Jerry Weintraub wasn't there. It was something to send to the head of the studio at Columbia, Guy McElwain. And Pat made me so comfortable, and he was, he was just so gracious. And then we became really good friends, and we saw each other several times a year. And we did, a couple of movies together, down the line. And he's a really fun character. We miss him because it would have been fun. I don't think he would have been a focus of this show. This show is really focused around Billy. But it certainly would have been interesting to have him in there and around as some sort of mentor for Ralph, for Daniel's character. Because, his quality, his dynamic has not been reproduced by anybody. He was a entity in this trilogy, in this chapters of cinema called Karate Kid. He was, his own icon. And he's an icon to everybody because Jackie Chan doesn't do, Mr. Miyagi. Shiro Mifumi doesn't do it. Nobody does. There's nobody that does.
Yeah, I really appreciate you, Martin, and thank you so much, and I wish you much success. Season 2, Cobra Kai, it's coming out April 22nd, I believe?
Yeah, April 22nd is the premiere we have in L.A., and then April 24th, it'll be premiering on YouTube, and you'll really enjoy it, If you enjoyed how Season 1 ended, you will definitely enjoy how Season 2 begins.